This episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast is brought to you with NFU Mutual, offering you tailored farming insurance and a local personal service.
Supermarkets are a key player in the food supply chain, and this review was designed to reform how farm insurance works in the UK. And for me, when I look at that, it's hard to see how the review can be truly meaningful if retailers are just refusing to engage with it. So the fact that supermarkets aren't even bothering to participate in this review, which was set up as a result of farmer anger, let's not forget, will feed into those feelings.
Britain's big retailers refuse to engage with a farm assurance review. We find out what it means for growers and livestock producers. Could a breakthrough by British scientists mean the end of classical swine fever? And why the world needs more red meat? Welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. I'm Johan Tasker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
All that and more coming up, but first we go straight to our top story. A progress report on improving farm assurance across the UK has struggled to gather input from major supermarkets, with the British Retail Consortium, the umbrella body for the big retailers, refusing to participate. The review's examining how the food supply chain is responding to more than 50 recommendations to make farm assurance fit for the future, but only three individual retailers, Lidl, Marks & Spencer and Morrisons, have submitted responses. The only mentioned interaction from Sainsbury's was to reject the idea of paying farmers a premium for demonstrating environmental performance above the legal minimum. Well, joining us now is Farmers Weekly Deputy Editor Abby Kay, has been following the story. Abby, a very mixed response here. What's going on?
Well, let's take a look at this report and just note to begin with that it was a bit of a mark your own homework exercise in some ways. So organisers were invited to submit evidence on how they, on the work they had done to meet these recommendations by using a kind of scorecard. And it was clear that some had made more progress than others. Bread Tractor in particular had done quite a bit around improving communication with farmers. So they've put a new communications plan in place. They're also taking steps to try to improve culture, their workplace culture, by regularly surveying sector boards on the effectiveness of their leadership. But there is still a lot of work to be done in other areas. Perhaps one of the areas where there's been very little progress that I would say is actually really, really important in the context of why this review was set up is the lack of progress on the recommendation that farmers should be rewarded for meeting enhanced environmental or animal welfare standards. So there still seems to be quite a bit of serious disagreement about this among the different actors in the supply chain. So some retailers have suggested that reward can come in non-financial form. So it might be advice or consultancy to improve the farm business. That was Morrisons who suggested that. Then you've got other retailers like Sainsbury's who just said, actually, this shouldn't be rewarded at all. All businesses should be working to become more sustainable because it just makes good business sense. So it feels as though these two parts of the supply chain are actually on quite different pages on this issue.
Some supermarkets then engaging with the process on an individual basis, but elsewhere, Abby, not at all. And you describe this as a little bit of a mark your own homework exercise. The British Retail Consortium, the umbrella organisation for Britain's big supermarket chains, not actually doing any homework at all, refusing point blank to take part in the review.
Yeah. That is true. So there were three retailers who submitted individual responses, but the BRC as a whole has just refused to participate. And for some sectors, that's more significant than others. So cereals, for example, retailers are perhaps less of a powerful force, but supermarkets are a key player in the food supply chain, and they play a really important role in standard setting and assurance as a whole. You know, and you said at the start, this review was designed to reform how farm assurance works in the UK. You know, it was going to look at the overall purpose, cost of assurance, the audit burden, all these kind of things. And for me, when I look at that, it's hard to see how the review can be truly meaningful if retailers are just refusing to engage with it. And there's a broader point here as well. Like, one of the main issues farmers had with assurance, and Red Tractor specifically, actually, was this sense that it was something that's done to them rather than something that they actually had a stake in and that provided a real benefit to them. So the fact that supermarkets aren't even bothering to participate in this review, which was set up as a result of farmer anger, let's not forget, will feed into those feelings. I think Red Tractor even kind of gave evidence that said some retailers saw this as a distraction and not a priority. Well, that's certainly not the way that farmers feel about it. And again, it just feels as though these parts of the supply chain, again, are just on different pages. They're just coming at this from a completely different angle and not seeing eye to eye.
So, sticking with the homework analogy, will the British Retail Consortium get hauled into the head teacher's office for not participating? Will they get detention, or can they just carry on not doing their homework?
Well, the commissioner doesn't actually have any real power to even bring the BRC into the headmaster's office. So the report was explicit in leaving the door open for future BRC involvement, and it actually expressed a hope that, you know, they would come on board in future. But they have no means to compel them to do that. I mean, in the meantime, other organisations can get on with working to meet the recommendations where they can, and they don't need that involvement. But, you know, the real test of whether any of this makes any difference will be felt on farm, ultimately, in whether the audits have become simpler, you know, less frequent, more streamlined, lighter touch. And can that happen without the retailers? That'll be for you to see on farm and to let people know if that's not the case.
So where do we go from here?
There will be another report monitoring the progress on whether these recommendations have been met. That's going to be out next spring. So we'll wait to see what happens with that.
Farmers Weekly Deputy Editor Abby Kay, thank you for joining us here on the podcast. So Hugh, Louise, some supermarket chains taking part in this review, but others simply not bothering with it. The BRC just CBA, as it were.
Yeah, mixed levels of engagement indeed. You have to wonder, don't you? I mean, were they given enough time to engage? I don't know. I'm not quite sure of the process behind all this. Three of the supermarkets did engage, and it's quite interesting, isn't it, that one of those is Lidl, and we talked about them, didn't we, the other week, because they just put another, wasn't it, £30 billion into supporting British farming. So it's good that some of them did. The BRC didn't. They're obviously too busy and not that enamoured with the system as it is. And, you know, actually, it wasn't just the retailers. Three of the four UK governments failed to respond. Only the Welsh government did respond. So that's interesting as well. And I hope, as I said before, that they were all given enough time to get their responses in, that they did understand that a response was needed. Gosh, Red Tractor, it's the slowest tractor in the world, isn't it? This thing just keeps on grinding on, and we don't seem to be moving forward, really. And that's a shame, because you know, that's what farmers are telling us. You know, nothing's changing when they have their inspections, nothing, or audits. It's just as bad as it ever was.
Hugh, more of the same, and should we be concerned about this lack of engagement in some quarters?
Yes, as Louise says, it's the gift that keeps on giving. It is disappointing that the progress of the review has been steady. I think it's worth taking into account that there are lots of people that work within the Red Tractor team. When I say lots of people, it's not a massive team. But that team have been working really hard to change a lot of stuff. And when you speak to them, there's loads of stuff going on there. Now, it could be that, you know, for the externals, they're not moving fast enough, and that's probably a fair judgment. But then equally, they're waiting for their cue from the review, from industry, from the supply chain, et cetera, et cetera. So it is really annoying that this has, you know, given the psychodrama, as I refer to it every time, that we went through back in the autumn of 23, and outrage from Outrage Shire was very cross, and everyone was jumping up and down and stamping the tables. Then no one turned up to half the consultation meetings that were organised for the farmers the following spring. Everyone realised a load of stuff needed to be done, and we haven't, yes, moved forward very far. I think what's really disappointing is some of the lines you said about the government's not responding, and the Welsh government, fair play, they have. Interestingly, in my sector, in red meat, there was the least concern from people around farm assurance and red meat from Wales, because they believe it works really well and they like how it works most of the time. It's really disappointing that government hasn't responded, because there's loads of opportunity, particularly around earned recognition and areas like that, that government could get involved with farm assurance, and it could actually be really useful for everyone involved. It's disappointing that not all of the retailers have got on board, because even the retailers like Sainsbury's, who haven't, they've never recognised Red Tractor forever. But then when you read their standards, they're very similar to the Red Tractor standards, but obviously they're for Sainsbury's. So the whole concept and the principle of farm assurance is absolutely essential to our supply chain. And some people would disagree vehemently with me, but I think for customer reassurance, for what customers expect out of the supply chain, and particularly in my sector, in the red meat sector, it's a really key part of it. So yeah, it is just really disappointing that it's not moved forward. Let's not forget, Red Tractor is the biggest of all the farm assurance schemes that's going. And actually, just to ignore it or not to respond or not to get on, it's just a really dumb thing to do. We've got to get this moving forward. And obviously, with all the changes that are now going to go on Red Tractor at the top, Jim Mosley retiring, perhaps there's an opportunity there to get someone in the seat that will really chase the horses on and get this moving and get some momentum and make it what it needs to be.
Well, we did ask the BRC why they didn't engage, and they sent us a statement which said, "We didn't have anything additional to add to the ongoing review and knew our resources would more efficiently help farming through our continued support for assured food standards and lobbying government to prioritise increasing UK farm production in its new food strategy." That's the BRC statement. And we wouldn't be doing our job properly either if we hadn't asked review author David Llewellyn whether he was concerned about the lack of engagement. Now, David's work schedule meant he couldn't talk to us this week, but we're hoping to get him on the podcast next week. There are some other alarm bells here as well, Louise.
One of the sticking points I notice, and this has interested me, is that they're not agreeing that farmers should be rewarded for meeting enhanced standards. Now, I find that really strange, because I have written a couple of articles recently where farmers are very much being rewarded for being part of a more sustainable supply chain. So there are companies, and I know this is in the arable sector now, where they are rewarding financially farmers who are growing their crops in a certain way. So I'm surprised that's a sticking point, and I'm not quite sure whose side that was a sticking point on, really. It is happening. There are financial rewards being given.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, a special word with this week's podcast partner, NFU Mutual, and I'm joined by NFU Mutual's Sean McCann. Sean, some big changes ahead when it comes to inheritance tax.
I think the changes can have the biggest impact on family farms is the proposal to limit the value of agricultural and business assets that can be passed down free of inheritance tax. Because the way it works at the moment is if you own and farm your own farm, and you have done for at least 2 years, you can, in most cases, pass it on completely free of inheritance tax, regardless of its value. But from next April, that's changing. So from that point, there'll be a cap on the value of agricultural and business assets you can pass down tax-free on your death. And it's going to be set at £1 million a person. Now, if you pass on assets valued at more than £1 million, half the excess will be tax-free, but the other half will be included when calculating your inheritance tax bill.
And NFU Mutual are offering advice to farmers to limit that liability.
Yeah, we don't yet have the final legislation, so it's important to take advice before you take any sort of irreversible decisions. And it's important to say that £1 million allowance is per person. It's not per farm or business. So what that means is that a couple could potentially take advantage of two £1 million tax-free allowances. But what that will necessitate in some circumstances, each of the couple will have to have sufficient assets in their own name. in order to take advantage of both allowances. So this is where the right advice can help you maximise the allowances that are available.
And how can farmers get advice?
Well, you can call us 0800 622 323, or you can contact your local NFU Mutual Agency office. And basically, we'll explain the sort of the advice services that we offer and any charges that apply.
Sean McCann from NFU Mutual, this week's Farmers Weekly podcast partner. Thank you very much.
The Farmers Weekly podcast.
Now, scientists at the Roslin Institute have used gene editing to develop pigs with resistance to classical swine fever, offering hope for protecting livestock against what is a highly infectious viral disease. Classical swine fever has a huge impact on global pig production, and I asked Dr. Simon Lillico, research scientist at the Roslin Institute, whether this was the breakthrough producers have been waiting for.
That sounds like a simple question, but it's probably more difficult to answer than you would think. I think no science is probably truly a breakthrough. It's all built on what's come before. We already knew from work in cell cultures that modification of the gene that we changed in our pigs had a good chance of working in the context that we did our experiments. But then work that's done in cells in cell culture is a cell that is out of context. So a cell that is isolated from a functioning immune system, for example. So this was a breakthrough in terms of nobody had ever modified this gene in a livestock species before, and certainly nobody had looked at it in a live animal in the context of pestivirus infection.
So explain to me then sort of what you did, I guess, and how it works.
So viruses need to infect a host cell in order to reproduce themselves. And once they've got themselves inside of a cell, they need to hijack normal cell processes in order to make more viral particles, which then need to get out of that cell and into new cells and repeat the process. So there are several steps in that where it might be possible to interfere with the ability of the virus to do what it needs to do. For classical swine fever, we identified a key pig protein that the virus absolutely has to interact with in order to copy itself. And then we use gene editing to modify the gene that codes for the protein that the virus needs to interact with to block that interaction from happening. And the outcome of that is that our gene-edited pigs are now completely resistant to classical swine fever virus infection.
And how soon, Simon, do you think this could be commercially available?
Again, that's a really difficult question for me to answer because I'm a research scientist, although I do have some knowledge of where regulations stand at the moment. And it really depends where in the world you are. So I'm presuming most of your listeners are based in the UK, but there are good, solid, well-understood regulatory processes in countries like Brazil, Argentina, the US, Canada, on application of gene editing in livestock as food products. In the UK, or in England at least, we have the Precision Breeding Act, which allows gene editing in crops, but not yet in livestock. The framework is there for livestock, but we still wait for secondary legislation around welfare issues. And I think that's vitally important that we have that in there. With respect to pipeline to market, obviously, as a research scientist, I sit at one end of that pipeline. I do the research and then hope that a company is going to take it up and progress it towards market entrance. For the timeline that you're talking about, all I can do is give you an indication of my previous experience of that. So about 10 years ago, we did similar work making pigs that were resistant to porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome virus. And that was taken up by a breeding company. And they have progressed that to market through a number of different regulatory regimes in different countries, and now have positive determinations in several of those, including in the US. That took, as I say, about 10 years. We are anticipating sale of the first pigs with that gene edit within the next 2 years. Now, for these pigs that we've just done now, I would anticipate that that journey, if taken up by a company, would be quicker, because the PRRS-resistant pigs were the first gene-edited pigs in that sort of space. So they were really testing the systems as was.
And does it mean the end of classical swine fever, or do you think resistance could be overcome?
I am always very reluctant to say that something cannot happen. However, the change that we've made is in a critical protein for viral interaction, which means the virus doesn't reproduce in cells. So it can get into a cell, but that's it. It can't make more copies of itself. For a virus to evolve around a genetic change, it needs to be able to make copies of itself. So it seems to me unlikely that the virus will be able to evolve around this, but hand on heart, I cannot say that it will not ever happen.
So it does seem then that this is a great success.
We certainly view it as a great success. I think I would also like to point out that I'd never refer to the sort of gene editing work that we do as being the solution to any given problem. I would view this as an additional solution to run alongside current biosecurity and vaccination strategies.
That's Dr. Simon Lillicoe of the Roslin Institute. Sir Hugh, a great success, if not a breakthrough.
It is. Some would say it's a breakthrough. Obviously, Simon Lillicoe was being guarded there because you never know what's around the corner or what might mutate or might change, because this is biology. It's a good step forward. It's a bit like the PRRS thing. You mentioned the PRRS thing. That's taken a long time to develop, but in terms of what that delivers, and actually in some ways the PRRS thing is you know, going to be noticed. Obviously, it's got approved before this. It was discovered and developed before this one. That PRRS one, in terms of the impact that's likely to have on production efficiency as it's rolled out globally, is absolutely huge. Obviously, the swine fever thing is quite a terminal thing, because if they've got it, like in this country, God forbid, it's a notifiable disease and the animals are culled. It's a useful thing. It's another useful tool in the box, Johan.
Well, PRRS, of course, being porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, PRRS. Before we started recording this, Louise did point out too that classical swine fever is different to African swine fever, Hugh.
Yeah, they're two different viruses, effectively. The PRRS thing is all of this gene edit stuff is you know, has huge potential to deliver where it is possible to make a simple edit. Now, simple edit, because remember there are certain conditions that affect animals which involve lots of genetic pieces of code, effectively, whereas the PRRS one was a classic. I remember going to a conference last year and the guy that did it was explaining how they did it. They literally found one protein out of many that if they turned this, there were seven proteins on a string, and the edit for PRRS is basically you turn off one of the seven proteins and it stops the disease in its tracks. It's as simple as that. And it's affected, you know, one chromosome, one part of the of the genetics. Whereas some conditions involve lots of different interactions. So therefore, to turn all of those off is nigh impossible, or would have an impact elsewhere on the animal. So these are good results, and we're probably over time going to see more of them. But they will take obviously a lot of investment, because the challenge now, and again the PRRS thing is a good example of this. It was only approved in May of this year by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the first animal edit application they had. It took years to go through their regulatory process. So this will take some time to actually get to market.
And Louise, the science here moving much more quickly than the law. That's something that we see in the arable sector as well, where gene editing, you know, we can do it in the lab, but as yet in the UK, we can't actually use it, even though the trials are going on.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, Simon did point out, didn't he, in the audio that actually we have had the secondary legislation passed for doing this in plants, in crops, but not in animals. So, you know, when we've talked about gene editing before and as Hugh said, this massive potential that it has to offer, you know, we have really focused on crops and on plants and what's happening in that world. Animals, as I say, they're a bit behind, but actually it sounds as though the researchers aren't behind. The researchers are way ahead. And yeah, again, in this case, they have identified and been able to alter the protein that this virus has to react with. So it has benefits, you know, beyond just for producers. It go right the way into society. So it is a fantastic development, even if it isn't a breakthrough. But yeah, it's going to take a while, isn't it? That the route to market and the commercialization, they're not so clear yet. And, you know, he was talking there, wasn't he, about sort of 10-year timeframes, possibly more. But it does show, doesn't it, what's possible.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
At Avant, we crafted compact loaders for arable farming that transform the way you work. Our machines offer unparalleled versatility and efficiency, serving as your partners in productivity. With a wide range of attachments, Avant loaders assist in field preparation, crop care, and harvest activities. Their powerful hydraulics and compact design ensure smooth operation in tight spaces. Join the thousands of farmers who trust Avant for their best yields. Avant, innovation that works as hard as you do. Search for Avant now.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You're listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Welcome along wherever you're listening to us from. You can email us podcast@fwi.co.uk. And if you're in the UK itself, you can also message us by texting the word farm, followed by your message to 88440.
Louise, a moving story on BBC Countryfile this week. A farming family in turmoil because of the decision to impose inheritance tax on farmers, and terminally ill farmer David Rees telling the BBC's Charlotte Smith he's considering taking his own life so the farm can stay in the family.
Yes, it was very, very moving, wasn't it? And I have to say, hats off to the Rees family who farm down in Pembrokeshire. They went on the programme. They explained their situation, which is not a good situation to be in. I thought hats off too to Charlotte Smith. I think she handled the interview with them very well indeed. I have met Tom Rees on a few occasions because he was an AHDB monitor farm. So quite a few people will have been out to the farm and attended some of the sessions there. But we have to say we wish the Rees family all the very best, and we hope that they can, you know, move forward in the best possible way, really. But well done to them for highlighting this issue, because it really does tug at your heartstrings, doesn't it?
And the Rees family, one of thousands of farming families going through this, but... well, it takes something to go on national television and talk about it too.
Yeah, real courage from them. And as you rightly say, Johan, there are many other farming families throughout the country who are facing similar situations, and really are being very stoic, very brave. But it's not a good situation. And, you know, to face the loss of your farm and of your business when you're possibly also facing the loss of a family member is it's just awful.
Yeah, extremely brave of that family. And like you say, there are lots of other people doing a lot of worrying at the moment because of all that's above. One thing that caught my eye, someone very kindly WhatsApped it to me, and I happened to miss it in the magazine, but it was Charles Whittaker from Brown & Co. His letter in the letters of the Farmers Weekly last week, which basically I think does a really good job. I think we're all agreed. I know you looked at it as well, Louise. It pretty much encapsulates what is not happening in farming at the moment and where it's headed, unless there's some policy or some change of tack And this is coming from not small farms. If anything, you know, you could argue that the small farms are slightly more less exposed because the numbers are smaller, the risks are smaller. This is coming from the point of view where, you know, as Charles describes it, broadacre operators are seriously now questioning, you know, what is the point? And it's pretty disturbing, you know, and that's in a part of the world where crops generally yield pretty well because they've got great soils and da-da-da-da-da. So let alone what's happening, as we know, particularly in the arable sector, in places like where I live, where it's all rubbish, grade three land, and there's no margin to be had at all. But I think it highlights that. And it's just, yeah, we're talking about the inheritance tax thing. Obviously, the budget's coming up. But just the damage all of this is doing to the industry week on week. And then I heard something the other day, someone talking about impact and what's happening with some of the machinery dealers now, which is really quite terrifying. The fact that, you know, the stuff is just not being sold. And you worry going forward in the long term, the impact this is going to have on farming's infrastructure. Because if these businesses start to contract and close down because they're not doing enough, and it's not just here, it's happening in other parts of the world, but specifically here, you know, it's just hugely, hugely worrying. And it just needs a change. And we keep saying it every blooming week, but it just needs a change of tack. I mean, there are some bright spots, whether we talk about beef prices, but there's lots of down spots as well. When we talk about wheat prices and tax policy, lack of investment, balance sheets going all over the place, and the supply industry really suffering and having a hard time. And we mustn't forget that because, you know, they're key to what we do, and yet they're not having a good time of it.
Now, one uplifting story in an otherwise gloomy week. Young farmers in Cambridgeshire say they're doing a roaring trade selling manure for charity. Soham YFC selling Soham FYM farmyard manure, raising money for the Farming Community Network and the Brain Tumour Trust. Richard Freeman from Little Downham in Cambridgeshire saying it's been a bumper year for manure sales, Louise. You spotted this on BBC News Online.
Yeah, I did. And I was impressed, really. I think it's something that they do every year. I don't think this is the first time that they've done it, but he makes the point in that article that he feels there must have been a television program or something that suddenly persuaded all these people that they needed to get some well-rotted manure onto their gardens, because he said the demand is greater than ever this year. But, you know, that's fantastic. We know it's good stuff, don't we? And, you know, they're raising money for charity as well. So really good. Well done to them. And yeah.
Really good news then for some young farmers. Hugh, really good in the markets too. What's happening with this week's commodity prices in association with the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board?
Thank you very much, Johan. Finished their deadweight this week, 651 dead, up from 647.7 last week. Live weight average, 375.7. That goes up almost 10p on the week. On to the sheep rings, and it's pretty steady there. It's dropped back marginally. It was 662.3 last week, the SQQ on the deadweight. This week it's 661.4. The live weight goes up, though, about 8p this week, 308.3. So those sheep prices are doing pretty well. Pig price, I'm afraid, drops back 0.4 of a penny, 203.6. Wheat price, there's a little bit of capital coming to the market. Not sure why. 166 quid spot this week for feed wheat. That's up nearly 4 quid on the week. Milling wheat, 180.30. That goes up just over £3 a tonne. Feed barley also up, 145.30. Up from 142.40 last week. Oilseed rate goes up as well, 409.40 this week. That's gained, well, it's got nearly 15 quid on the job in the week. In fact, looking at the figures, this week's oilseed rate price is almost the same. In fact, it's 30p more than it was a year ago, and it was 409.10. So it's, all seed rates doing all right. Feed peas, 193 dead. That's dropped back 30p on the week. Feed beans, 202. They go back 2 quid on the week. Oil prices, they'll maybe be going down, but the diesel price has gone up. After the wondrous 65.5 pence a litre price last week, I'm afraid we've added about 3p. It's gone up to 68.56, was the Wednesday morning ring round average red diesel price.
Thank you, Hugh. And for trusted market data delivered straight to your inbox, visit the AHDB Preference Centre at ahdb.org.uk/market-data to sign up for and customise AHDB market emails.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast. The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, the world is short of red meat. That, perhaps understandably, is the conclusion of delegates at the World Meat Congress this week. Earlier, Hugh caught up with NFU National Livestock Chairman David Barton, who's at the conference in Brazil.
David, World Meat Congress, is there enough meat in the world?
I think the answer to that is red meat is very short, Hugh, and beef is supplies particularly tight at the moment. Lamb also, and I think just looking at all the statistics that we've had, the common theme is that, you know, demand is ever increasing and supply is just diminishing slightly everywhere. So if you're in the business of growing and finishing red meat, that's quite a good place to be, really.
And David, from a global perspective, is there much talk of shortage in lamb supply chains as well?
The major lamb sheep meat producers, which we are one, we were the only one that grew, and we grew by about 0.4%. So it's quite a small growth. But the other significant producers were all ticking down a little bit. So again, that supply is going down. So, I think it's we're set on a course that we need to sort of increase production, and no one really knows, certainly with beef, how that's going to really happen. It's no one has the answer, but we can all foresee the problem, but we do just need to produce more, and it's a great opportunity for us in the UK, Hugh.
And was there much mention this week? The USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins has been talking about how they need to onshore their beef production, and they've got great packages they're planning to roll out to US colleagues to bolster their numbers. Were the US colleagues there upbeat, or are they wondering where these cattle are actually going to come from?
I think they're a little unsettled, I think is how I'd put it at the moment. We did have quite a good panel session with US and European colleagues, and that was a little prickly, to say the least, but interesting all the same. But they have different perspectives of what should and shouldn't be happening.
And you've been out there talking about split gas accounting and trying to convince the rest of the world that that's where we should be going when we're accounting for our emissions. Are they listening to you?
Well, I think so. I mean, we had a meeting back in May with our president, Tom Bradshaw, and Kate Acton, president of the Beef and Lamb from New Zealand, and which was a very positive meeting. And from that meeting, we really got on board with that and have been, I think, a very good ally to Beef and Lamb New Zealand. And it's just that collaboration, recognising this is a really serious issue. We need to sort it out. And so, you know, you put any sort of trade issues aside, because this is a non-competitive issue. This is something that is really important, and I think we've worked very closely with them, and I'm really pleased that we've done that. So we've been very proactive, and from the conference, the signatures have grown. So I think now it is something like 30 different companies have signed that, and 13 different countries. So what that I think that means is we're starting to get to a position now where this is something that is of such a size internationally that it cannot be ignored, because any individual country could come up with this idea and you know, it wouldn't get any traction. Certainly if we did, I mean, who would listen? But the fact that we're collaborating and coming together with like-minded countries, and so that I think we made quite a big part of the conference. We had a session on Monday at the IMS meeting, and which we had an hour to discuss, which was really useful. So I put our point of view across from a producer's point of view. I see this as potentially a really dangerous area for us, and we need to get into position. I mean, as a producer, I just want to feel that any emissions that my livestock create are being accounted for correctly. They currently aren't, and we know that. So this is a one big step forward to getting to there. But there's still a road to go down yet. But it's a really good step forward.
Now, as well as being sat in your international conference room, you've been doing a few farm tours. Tell us the challenges that the Brazilians have on the ground there. Are they much the same as us? Is weather one of their big challenges?
I think it probably is, but they're used to it and they manage it very well. We visited a ranch today, which was large scale. I think it was 15,000 head of cattle on a sort of a large rotational grazing system, if you like, grazing the grass that they have, 18 hectare paddocks, and moving them around. And when they go into the dry season, they have two ways of doing it. They either feed them in the bunks, which they were doing there, or they can just naturally graze. But what they're doing is resting the grass. So basically, they're in a sort of sense similar to what I do at home. They're just making the best use of the grass that they have and the weather conditions that they have to go with it. So I think when you visit other countries and look at the way they produce, the thing that I just see is that wherever farmers farm in the world, they just do the very best they can with the environment and conditions that they have. And I mean, that's what we do in the UK, and that's what they're doing here. So very different styles of farming, producing a very different product. I'm not sure, if I'm really honest, I don't know whether environment is quite such a big issue for them as perhaps it is for us. That was the feeling I got.
Presumably with the Brazilian government and the Brazilian economy, the ag turnover is so huge that it probably gets a bit more of its own way.
We're in the state of Mato Grosso, and the governor came and sort of spoke to us on Monday evening, and it's a big part of what they do. I mean, there's 3.5 million people in this state, which is the size of France and Germany put together, and there's 34.5 million cattle. So they're significant, and that's going to drive their focus will be very different to what we have in the UK. I mean, it's a big part of their economy, so very important, yeah.
That's the NFU's David Barton in Brazil. So, Hugh, David making some interesting points. More red meat required, but the sector faces challenges too.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, if you think about it, the challenges they're facing now, and actually, you know, it's a good news piece from a purely farm business point of view, because the beef is expensive, the cattle are in short supply, the prices are high wherever you go in the world. But that's all because of all the horrendous last 50 years of challenges, whether that's around low prices, whether that's around regulation, and more importantly, more recently in the last 10 to 15 years around climate, that there are less cattle being grown because of all those pressures. But it leaves us in a situation where there is loads of opportunity, there's loads of room to fill up, and there's money to be made, effectively.
Louise, markets are different for different commodities, but climate change affects all of us.
Oh, absolutely it does. And I'm sure that's something that they have been discussing in quite some detail at this Congress. There are other things, aren't there? I mean, consumer public perception, I'm sure, is something that crops up the world over. Disease and the spread of diseases, because we're hearing a lot more about that. And again, I know that's related to climate change. And then, of course, we have our own little peculiar difficulties, if you like, or challenges. And obviously the one here in England is TB, where you're keeping cattle. Now, I'm not familiar enough with beef production to know what sort of peculiar ones they'll have in other countries like that. But I'm sure, yeah, as I said, plenty for them to discuss, plenty to compare notes on. And I would think, a lot of agreement, really. I don't know what the labour situation is in other parts of the world, but all farms seem to be having issues with labour. So, loads for them to get their teeth into.
Labour, a big issue. Protein, Hugh, a big issue too.
Yeah, it's huge. And it's, well, across all the meat. And I think it's almost like, dare I say it, but if you go back 5 or 6, 7 years when veganuary was massive and the world was going to survive on beans and peas and pretend it was 1732 and wear a smock and never farm another thing, we've come a long way from there, haven't we? And I think consumers have woken up to the fact, and I'm not saying, yeah, we probably do in the long term need to be smarter about how and what and the amount of meat that we consume. But I think consumers have absolutely led the way here because they've been given the opportunity. And I think we started, the fight back really came, and credit to HDB, actually. If you think about, if you look at their Eat Well Balance campaign over the last 3, 4, 5 years, you know, it's just chipped away at that messaging saying, actually, you know, you can eat meat. It is a really important part of your diet. It's done really well here in the UK, so get on with it. And people are. And also the flip side of that is consumers waking up to the whole dearth of, you know, ultra processed. And when they look at these meat free options, they look at the packets and go, my God. And look, there is some phenomenal vegan cookery that have beautiful unadulterated ingredients, and I've tried it and it's amazing. But there's also a lot of rubbish out there. We know that. And there's a huge lashback or a push against ultra-processed. So it's almost shot itself in the foot and then opened the floodgates, people wanting unadulterated product, unadulterated proteins. And meat is, you know, one of the most unadulterated things that you can buy in the shop along with fresh fruit and veg. And surprise, surprise, the margin on all of that is really tight at every level of the supply chain. But the other thing to consider is the environmental. And I think we are understanding more and more about the impacts that our production systems have or don't have. Big breakthrough or breakthroughs happening with lots of countries. And as David mentioned in the audio there about split gas accounting, and more countries recognizing that as a more accurate way of judging the environmental impact of emissions from beef systems and all farming systems, as opposed to just bundling everything up and saying it's a CO2 equivalent. It's actually looking at the different things, the methane, the nitrous oxide, and the CO2, all in separate silos, and actually judging what their impact is. And then there's loads of work to be done around efficiency of systems, around, you know, whether we're talking about optimizing genomics, optimizing feed. So yeah, there's loads to be really actually quite hopeful about here. It's a phenomenal product. We talk specifically about beef here, but of course, red meat with lamb. And this is the World Meats Congress, so they're talking about pork as well, and all of the meats. Lots to do, lots to be buoyant about. And the great thing is that consumers are buying into it and they're loving it. And we should really be, you know, happy about that and do more to effectively fulfill that demand.
And that's it for this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast. We do hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've really enjoyed what you've heard, please do leave us a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with all the latest news, views and analysis of all the big stories affecting UK agriculture. But for now, until next week, I'm Johan Tusker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
Thank you for listening. This episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast was brought to you with NFU Mutual, offering you tailored farming insurance and a local personal service.